No, another senator.
Which, if you, depending upon where we're at on these two conversations, we can,
could have been the quorum.
All right, we have a quorum.
Welcome.
Senator Hayden.
How are things on the floor? There's, we're back to discuss Senate file, House File 2531. We had, last meeting we agreed on the 1, 2, 8, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 16, 17, all in. And there are things on the table that we need to discuss. One is the A7 amendment that we had brought forward from the Senate side, and then there were two House amendments, House File 1986 and 1961. And I think for the sake of information, am I missing anything? Yeah, there was one other amendment that folks wanted to bring forward, which was John Marty's amendment. But we can sure have that discussion as we go on. Representative Erdahl, are you familiar with the two House amendments that were brought forward? I think you were. Maybe we should give him an idea of where we're at on those.
We need to be.
Let's review them.
Okay. So, Representative Halverson, do you want to talk about 1961?
Sure thing, Mr. Chair. House File 1961 is a bill that has been heard in committee and passed off the House floor. It includes additional disclosure and public integrity for elected officials, public officials, including adding a must provision to audits and investigations, including adding spousal disclosure when there might be a conflict of interest, and which we find is kind of practice among most elected officials as we survey them. And it also includes disclosure of individuals who are individual contractors regarding the associated businesses that they do business with. So not naming clients, but naming categories of income as per the IRS codes. It also clarifies that data is classified as private if it is private data. And that's a brief walkthrough of the provisions. So.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for Representative Halverson?
The must audits, could you just say that a little more clear?
So currently in statute, it does provide that the Campaign Finance Board may make audits and investigations with respect to the disclosure that we are required to do. It changes the may to a must within the resources of the Campaign Finance and Disclosure Board. So there's not a fiscal note attached to this piece of legislation for that reason, but it does increase the expectation for the board to do audits and investigations as needed.
So it's must, but as needed.
Must as there are resources available. And according to testimony that we heard from Mr. Goldsmith, those resources, because of the additional funding that was provided in the last session, that we have actually made those funds more available.
Great. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Halverson, just the questions come up to my mind. And maybe you've answered this before on the House floor or whatever, and I missed it. But on the spousal reporting, if a spouse refuses to do it, what is the penalty, and how is it paid?
Mr. Chair and
Representative
Erdahl, it's under the conflict of interest provisions that we so it's not the economic disclosure. So what it says with regard to spouses and their potential conflict of interest is that legislators are required to disclose a spouse's potential conflict of interest of an item that they might take action on. So I'm trying to think through a scenario where a spouse would refuse because it's really we're asking the legislator to add their spouse's financial interest. And if you recall, the financial interest that would make for a situation where we'd have to disclose a conflict of interest would be a unique and significant financial interest for that particular person. So if you were voting on, a particular plot of land or a particular interest that your spouse had, where it would give you or your spouse a significant and unique interest, then it's a potential conflict of interest and it has to be disclosed. So it's not every conflict of interest. It's not every time even you recuse yourself, because there's a lot of people who recuse themselves from voting on something that their spouse has an interest in, and even if it isn't a unique and significant interest. So.
Thank you. Representative Riddle? So and the other one that we had was House File 1986. Is there anybody, first of all, let me go back, anybody that wants to comment on 1961 in the room? Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, members, Gary Goldsmith, Campaign Finance Board Executive Director. I just wanted to make one comment on the mandatory audits. That's in Section 10A02. Of the statutes, and so that doesn't mean we would necessarily make mandatory audits of economic interest disclosure, but there would be a program of mandatory audits in the whole campaign finance and public disclosure system. So I don't want people to think that this bill would specifically say we have to audit economic interest statements, but we would have to develop an audit program.
Okay. Thank you. Next one that we had up was Senate File 1986. Which was, looks like, brought by Winkler. Does somebody from the House want to give us another update on what that's about?
Mr. Gary?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, the House File 1986 is Representative Winkler's bill. This is the bill that would revert the gift ban provisions back to the way they were before last session. So you may recall last session in the campaign finance bill,
yep. There
was an exception added to allow legislators and staff to accept a meal at a reception or meeting given by a principal or a lobbyist if all members of the legislature were invited at least 5 days in advance. So this House File 1986 would eliminate that exception, so basically revert the law to the way that it was before 2013.
Great, thank you. Anybody want to speak on that? Or is that okay? And the other thing that was the A7 amendment that we had talked about too, which was really a conversation, and I wish Senator New was here as well. But really, the whole discussion of prima facie determination, putting in statute finally an understanding of a definition of what prima facie is, and was cleaned up some other languages too, without just cause. I think one of the sticking points we had spent some time on was expedited rulemaking versus the sonar or the full rulemaking. And I know and that's where we're at with that. So any comments, conversations, questions on A7 amendment?
Mr. Chair, we'll probably have some more discussion as we go. We're just sort of laying everything on the table now.
Yep, just throwing it on the table. This is what we have left on the table to discuss.
I'll just throw out one very, very, very simple thing, which is just a typo on the A7 amendment 2.3. The notice must include the definition of a prima facie determination
period,
capital W, within 30 days after filing. The period and capital W were dropped.
Any discussion on the on that friendly amendment to the amendment? one of the council people or analysts want to?
Mr. Chair, that was my understanding as well. I think when we consider the A7, we could just incorporate that.
Yes.
Okay.
Change.
So, all right. Good. Do we need to take we don't need to take any action on that.
So,
okay. Good. So, what's the pleasure of this group? I have some reservations about the my intention of this bill, and the elephant's in the middle. I don't like to play around the bush, but we really wanted to get to some transparency issues, some prima facie determinations, probable cause stuff. We wanted to make sure that the Board of Governance was doing what they were doing. I know there are definitely some conversations that we're going to have regarding expedited conciliation agreements, not based on probable cause, et cetera, without just cause or with just cause. But I think one of the things that I'm concerned about is I have reservation in what I thought, and please correct me, and I'm open for any kinds of discussion, was that we simply wanted to look at the governance side, transparency side of the board and how the campaign finance board responds, and not to bring up, and this is just me talking now, and not to have added to it stuff. And even though it passed on the House floor, I've taken it back and talked with my leadership, and we do have some reservations about definitely 1961 and specifically 1986. So having said that, let's talk.
That's just interesting to me, Mr. Chair. Between 1986 and 1961, I have heard so many different things. I don't really know which one is the more difficult one for the Senate. The gift ban is revert back to what we've done forever. It's just been a 1 year that we've had that legislators could be given a free meal. That's all that one is. And 1961, Halverson has to do with the conflicts of interest or economic interest statements and some provisions in there. Can you really tell me which one is the one that's most uncomfortable for you? I mean, I've been hearing different things. Some people say, oh, they're really uncomfortable with this. They're really uncomfortable with that. So I don't really know.
So the other thing, too, that brings up is, both of the bills that you have in front of us, 1986, 1961, I know the companion, neither one of those made it through the Rules Committee on the Senate side. There's a third amendment, too, that is sitting out there that should be laid on the table and brought up on the table, too. But that's was a companion, I think, to 1986, and that was Senate File 1730. Is that correct? Senator Marty had that language. I think what if I were to say one or the other, my preference would be 1986 should not be included in our conversation. I think that has more of a problem than 1961 does.
Okay, and I will just say that, Mr. Chair, that 1730 was Marty, and the House bill was Freiberg.
Do you remember that? I thought the companion was 1986 on the House side.
No.
I was given wrong information. I'm sorry.
It has to do with all money from lobbyists. It's recorded down to a penny, not over $200.
Okay.
So.
I mean, how entrenched is the House in getting 1986 and 1961 passed through this? What otherwise was a pretty clean look at prima facie and board governance.
Mr. Chair, I would take it back to the fact that this bill was a technical bill of the Campaign Finance Board, which was really pretty innocuous, both House and Senate. And the Senate decided to add more to it, which is the discussion you've just had around your ideas of transparency. But that was the Senate's part, and the House had no part in that. So if we were to look at that, then it would be very nice to look also at some of the things that we passed fully all the way through across the House floor, all the way, and they just got stopped in your side at Rules.
Correct.
And that seems a fair thing to bring in comparison to you putting something on this technical campaign finance board bill that you want. So we would really like to see some of this public integrity stuff. That's why that comes forth, and I think that's a fair balance.
So, Mr. Senator Hayden.
So I appreciate you guys kind of bringing these forward. I would have to say that it didn't get through our process. I think that there were concerns that they had, and I don't think one of the reasons I don't know if it could have got through the rules. I do have a question, though, Representative Lane or one of your colleagues. So there was a lot about kind of this gift ban issue and kind of a lot made, but was there anything that came of it? And you may or may not know that, but was there even anybody that was invited to something that they had? And then if they did we feel like there was some gain of it? I just often feel like around here, one way or the other, is that we make these kind of loud pejorative statements that often reflect in us looking as if somehow a chicken dinner, if you will, is going to make us change our mind on a big issue, right? So I'm just saying, one, was there ever any event? And then secondly, this issue of the way that, you know, it often is portrayed is that somehow, you know, this meal that might be provided for the whole legislature may weigh in to decisions that we have to make around here.
Mr. Chair.
Madam Representative Lane, yeah.
2 points. One is a little point that when I was running for something in my town, there is actually a competitor who actually got taken all the way through their county attorney process because it wasn't under the campaign finance board. It was under chapter whatever that other what chapter is, and got fined $1,000 for just that, providing chicken as part of the enticement to get somebody to vote for him. But for this particular one, the gift ban, which is offering a meal to legislators, as long as you offer it to everybody, they can have it for free. An example would be the business partnership, which did that offer, and maybe they would only have particular people come, but now those people get it for free. And there was something in the agriculture world.
I believe it was the AURI did an event that where they invited the full legislature, but I'm not 100% sure if it was the AURI or another agricultural interest.
So
did an event for
Farm
the
Bureau,
whole legislature.
Probably.
Was it the Farm Bureau?
So it would be an example of putting it out there for everybody, knowing that not everybody would come, but those who came would get it free. So it's another loophole to provide a meal free for legislators to look at their particular agenda.
Representative Halverson and then Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point, we know these dinners take place and we can purchase our own chicken. I think that what the underlying story of this and the fact that it's been enacted in Minnesota law for so many years is really an expectation of the public. And there's also a question of access. So if you are a heavy-hitting group that has a lot of dues payers and you can put on a meal for 134 legislators or 201 legislators, and you can afford that, you can afford a whole lot of access outside the walls of the Capitol. If you're a group that cannot afford such a thing, you don't have the same access. And we tell a pretty amazing story of clean elections in Minnesota. And we have historically, and I always feel really good when I'm out on the campaign trail and they say, oh, you guys are all getting wined and dined all the time, and you can say, it's not happening in Minnesota. And it's not happening in Minnesota because we have such strong laws that there is not an inequality of access. You don't have to be well healed to get hurt at our state capitol like you do in other state capitals. And so it's a system, I think, that's worked well for Minnesotans. It's something that our citizens have come to expect, which is why we took it back up this year.
So
Mr. Chair, to that point.
Yep, Senator Hayden, and I just want to let Representative Erdahl know that we're going to that point. And then I just want to let Senator Hayden know we're having a discussion on Senator Newell. Who did I just say that?
So I understand that. The reality of it, and symbolism is important here, and we all want to show that we have good governance. But the reality here is that people who are well funded and have great access, and that they have more access than others anyways. you know, I make it a point to try to figure out people, citizen lobbyists and others and advocates, and to try to kind of bring them to this process. So the reality of it is that, well, I won't say all of us because I don't know how you operate, but we walk around in the halls every single day and we talk to people, and those that seem to be well-funded and have, you know, and have great lobbying firms and others tend to take up a lot of time and get a lot of access to us. So, you know, I'm just not sure that I buy, quite frankly, with all due respect, that this allows. I think that if you are an integrity-filled legislator, that a meal, or, you know, and I think within reason, I don't think we should get lavish gifts, but I don't necessarily think a meal is going to change any of our minds, and frankly change the perception of what people think about us in the state. I think they elect us because they know we do good work. I think they watch us very closely to see if what we say is in light of what we do, and I think that's how we get elected, and I think that's how some of us have gotten reelected based on that. I don't think that I've heard of anyone, frankly, now maybe our districts are different, that have said, you know, Hayden, you know, are you getting a steak dinner, and that's why you voted for the agriculture industry, or whatever the case may be. So I do think that, you know, I won't go that far to say much to do about nothing, because it's very important to a lot of people. I just don't feel like this is something that I could support. I think we need to have a lot more conversation and a much broader a sense in the Senate, with the full Senate, since this is kind of the provision that brought forward for me to be able to accept it. And I'm just not sure that I think that this is going to create that level of sunshine that makes us feel good. I think that we're like that today.
Representative Erdahl.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In a lot of the places where I go, frankly, they get around it anyway, because it's if you speak or intend to speak. I intend to speak wherever I go, so it kind of covers it. But, you know, at Farm Bureau, when we go to that meeting, we all have to get up and speak. Makes for a very long and boring session, I'll tell you.
Senator Newman, we're sitting on 1986. We just threw out what we've had discussion on, what's left to do, and number one is the A7 amendment, and then House Files 1986 and 1961. And I just want to clarify, Representative Lane, that Senate File 1730, which is Marty, is the same as House File 1986. So I did get clarification on that. Yeah. So. Yeah, so Senate File 1730 was Senator Marty's bill. So, and I know there's so many bills running out there. So we're all on the same page on that. So Senator Newman, welcome.
Thank you, and I apologize for being late. I was covering for you, Mr. Chair, on the Elections Conference Committee report with Senator Sitton.
Oh, oops. Thank you.
You're covered.
God, I'm glad somebody's covered me today. That's good. So, you know, the other thing that comes up, so I guess we keep continually talking about the technical bill, and this, some would mention, is this really germane to what we wanted to do regarding on the transparency of the board, the transparency that you know, how the board operates? And that's just a question to throw out there, Representative Lane.
Mr. Chair, I always like to clarify that the technical bill that we both started with was just that, a technical bill, and that the Senate added the piece that they're calling transparency, and the House did not, and that's where we stand.
Okay, so
there's a few other minor points too along the way, but those are the big ones.
We have an impasse, and I don't think so. I guess the pleasure of this group, 1986. Did we take a vote on that? Bring them up and either vote them up or vote them down, or is there a discussion on? I know that we can't accept. We have a roll call.
Okay.
Yeah, we're excused.
Did they send you them? I guess they did.
Since we're lining up possible balances to the piece you added to the transparency piece to the technical bill, do you want to have further discussion about the possibilities before you throw them off, or do you want to just start throwing one off?
We might end up with, and you know what, so be it. If we end up with nothing, you know, best alternative to negotiated agreement is to walk away from something and start all over again. I don't care. I mean, that's just, that's the business person inside of me, and so, but I think there's a fix here. I think we can get this. I think the work that we've tried to do throughout this whole process is really going to be about the how the board is operating, how the campaign finance board is operating, so that there is transparency and there's a public accountability. Now, having said that, do we need to go, Senator Hayden, and go and punch in?
Yeah.
All right.
Yep.
Sorry.
Are you going to be back?
Yes. Okay. We'll tell him. We'll be in recess for 2 seconds. However long it takes Senator Newman and I to.
Well, Senator Newman limps along. You want me to run over there and vote?
No. Maybe I missed
it. Cut my arm off up there.
You should. Shake him up a little.
I certainly do.
Very rude to not let him do any shenanigans. So.
Senator Hoffman?
Yeah.
When we were doing the same in adopting all the identical bills, identical sections last time, I indicated that this one might be part of our amendment, and it's not. So we could, if you wanted to adopt it, it's another economy section. You know, it's up to you. I just thought I'd mention that's another.
Which
identical
section is that?
It is House Section 6, Senate Section 9.
They're identical. We just missed it. So does Representative Lane want to make the motion to?
Yes, I had that on my list. It's identical. Yes.
Thank you.
I would move this House Section
9. Are you recording me?
Back in. Thank you. Mr. Chair, House Section 6 and Senate Section 9 are identical, and we could move that. I would move that.
So moved. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. It's moved. Thank you, Representative Lane. So let's go back to 1986.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Mr. Senator Hayden.
Are there any other same or similar provisions that we can move before we get to the substantive issue?
No, we did them all
right on. Okay, yeah, that's not sure.
First meeting we had, Senator Hayden. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
I would have a suggestion. Instead of trying to vote now in 1986, that we have discussed that, and now maybe we just set that aside and discuss 1961, and maybe so that we know what we're actually dealing with, and rather than trying to move them out and move us right into a corner.
Okay. You guys all right with that? I'm fine. So on that, Representative Lane, we'll go to 1961 then and have that discussion. So Representative Halverson gave a brief overview of what 1961 was and what it's about, and there's lots of questions on here, I know, from our side regarding official spouses and financial interests and all that stuff. So,
a comment, Mr. Chair?
Representative Lane.
As I understand it, the must-do audits as per resources instead of the may also goes with the fourth section in this bill, which has to do with, and the data that would be used in those audits remains confidential. So those two parts go together.
And that's section 4, correct? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is on page, here it is. There's the money. Okay. Thank you for clarifying. Any questions regarding Senate file 1961? Senator Newman.
My thoughts, and I'll try and be very succinct, my thoughts are these. Line 1.10, within limits of available resources, strikes me as being a very ambiguous term. On the next page, requiring a spouse to disclose financial interests or requiring a business associate to disclose financial interests seems to me to be a provision that, while I recognize we could put it into law, I don't know how in the world you'd ever enforce it.
Could I just speak to that?
Representative Lane.
It doesn't say that the financial interests of the spouse will be revealed. It says that when the financial interests of the spouse will be enhanced by the legislator taking a particular vote on it, if your spouse owned the property that the Franking Stadium was going to go on, that legislator should probably recuse themselves from that vote, because
the spouse would benefit greatly from that vote. So it's just a conflict of interest piece, not a revealing of any of the financial interests of the spouse at all. It's not putting it in any statement anywhere. It's just simply using it as a conflict of interest. Am I correct, Representative Halverson? Mr. Chair.
Representative Halverson, and then go to Senator Newman.
Certainly.
Finish his sentence.
Representative Lane had a very good overview of this. However, just as we do with our own conflict of interest, and I say that having never done this myself because it doesn't happen that often, at least in our body, there's a written statement that gets prepared that goes to the official's immediate supervisor. And if it's a legislator, it goes to the presiding officer of the body. It's not public necessarily, but it does provide an explanation when we do recuse ourselves from a vote to our presiding officer.
All right. Senator Newman?
Well, I think that the idea is a good one, but again, I don't know how you're going to enforce it. Because what we're really trying to get at is you know, assets that a spouse or a business associate may have, and if we are you're kind of taking it on your honor, I suppose, if there isn't any underlying disclosure. So how do you enforce that? That's just my thoughts. I mean, I guess I agree with the concept, but I think that maybe it would have to be reworked because while it's maybe a good idea to avoid the appearance of an impropriety, and I certainly agree with the legislator should recuse themselves if there is a direct conflict of interest because of financial interest. How do you enforce it? How do you disclose it without requiring the spouse to disclose the financial interest? So those are just my thoughts. I mean, the last thing that I object to 1961 would be line 3.21. The board may require an individual to disclose underlying data.
That's gone. If you gotta go.
I'm not going to do that.
Right.
I'm just not going to do it. That is my private, personal, financial information, and I don't think the Campaign Finance Disclosure Board has a right to know what that is. Now, if we put down financial information on that disclosure form, and the board finds out from an independent source that we have not told you, that's a whole different smoke. But I simply will not agree to the requirement that legislators are required to tell anybody that private information.
Thank you,
so
Senator.
So those are my thoughts on the bill.
You know, Representative Lane, and then I think I know Senator Hayden has to leave. I mean, this is like, you know, everybody's got other things to do. This is like, what's it called when you're doing something?
Chaos.
It's just like,
chaos.
Yeah, it is chaos. It's making sausage in a way that I don't like. So go ahead, Representative Lane. I'm sorry. I lost my train of thought for a second.
I just needed to respond to Senator Newman that this underlying data goes with, number one, where if somebody says that what you said in your economic interest statement was false, you would want the Campaign Finance Board to investigate that. You would want that to... You'd want some way to check into that.
Yeah.
And in order to do that, they would need to see information, and that's why number four is there that says anything they look at to verify this stays confidential. This will be confidential. No one else will see it, and it maintains that as confidential so that they can look and see if the economic interest statement was actually accurate. You can't have one without four. You can't have the checking, doing audits without having four to maintain that data confidential, or you would lose the very thing that you're concerned about, your privacy.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Senator Newman.
What I said was if the Campaign Finance Disclosure Board found out from an independent third-party source that a legislator had not told the truth on the on the disclosure form. Then I think the board would be at liberty to use that data, but I do not believe that the board has or should have the authority to require someone to come in and disclose their private financial affairs. Now, the only other thing I'll say about this is the this issue of it's going to be private and it can't be disclosed, and I will tell you that our state agencies are replete with leaks. And so the requirement that it is going to be kept confidential really gives me very little comfort.
Thank you, Senator Newman. Mr. Goldsmith, or is there anybody that wants to speak on 1961? I do have a question on the must-do audits, Mr. Goldsmith, if you want to help us. The cost of that, and I know you got to go, Senator Hayden, but, you know, how is this paid for? And I know I'd asked about was there a fiscal note, but now with the use of must-do audits, is that something that, that has a is now going to have a fiscal impact other than what you're doing typically at the –
Mr. Chair and members, no, because it has the caveat that it must do audits within available resources. And when board members asked me about this, I said it means we would have to elevate discretionary items to include audits. And remember that this is audits in any of the programs, so it wouldn't necessarily be audits in the economic interest program, but some audits. And so that would become a more higher priority for us than audits are now, which we haven't been doing because we have many other things to do before we get started.
Representative Lane.
Mr. Goldsmith, do you know if somebody were to independently say that somebody lied on their economic interest statement, do you have a way to do a complaint process around that?
Ms. Chair and Representative Lane, yes. In fact, we had some years ago we had a complaint filed on that very topic. The allegation was that a legislator had an interest in some real property where the Twin Stadium was going to be built, or one, it wasn't where it ended up being built, but one of the sites, and that hadn't been reported. And we didn't do an audit. We asked the person to establish whether he or she had that interest, and turned out that the person didn't. But had we been required to, we could have subpoenaed documents or subpoenaed testimony under our general investigative authority. But that would have been triggered by a complaint. I think there's some question. We haven't ever done an audit on our own where we needed to use any kind of subpoena authority, but we have a general authority to require the production of documents.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. There's still lots of discussion out there, and I don't know in the interest of time. Representative Lane, any suggestions on your part?
Or next moves?
Yep, next moves, because it's now becoming that way. So
we have some of the discussion around 1961. The other piece it includes is the people are independent contractors. They would just have the general category that comes out the IRS form, just the general category of their business listed also in their economic interest statement. So that's the third piece in there. So I just throw that out as another thing. But if we were then to look at A7 in the same light that we've looked at these two, I would have concerns around some of the things that are in the A7. For instance, you have suggested that maybe it doesn't have to be the regular rulemaking but could be expedited, and I would certainly want to see the expedited. But there are some concerns in there. For instance, in the prima facie situation, if you didn't add that warrants a formal investigation, you would be having to do a full investigation around even frivolous things. So there's some wording changes that needs to be cleared, I think, to actually satisfy your intent. Otherwise, we'll end up in more trouble than help. So something like that. Another one I'd throw out would be that there's something in the Senate bill in Section 7 of the bill that appears to misunderstand the statute, and it takes a division, a part that says that after an investigation,
then we'll keep this information confidential or give it back to the person, when in fact, if you change that to a prima facie, after a prima facie determination, you would do this. Now you have ruined the fact that after an investigation you don't do this because you've just substituted prima facie for investigation. So there's some things that a complexity in this way that A7 is written that probably get us into more trouble than help. There's another one in A7 in 4.17 to 4.21 where it takes and says that you would have to sue because you've added this new section 10A.34, and in fact this is an informal process of getting somebody to pay up what they owe, and if you all of a sudden have to follow what you would add in there that you have to sue them, your informal process of getting this in a collaborative fashion all of a sudden becomes a suit. These things are just misunderstandings, I believe, of what you're actually going for, and they would need to be cleaned up or we'd be in worse difficulty.
So do you have suggestions on how you would see the cleanup on that? If it's not, I thought it was pretty clear, but do you have any suggestions as far as what you would see as a cleanup language?
We could write up some suggestions as to how the things I've mentioned would be cleaned up. I don't have them written out in any form now.
All right. Suggestions.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Maybe we could have either Mr. Sandy or Mr. Goldsmith come in and address those issues, because what Representative Lane has just explained is not my understanding of what the board had in mind at all. In other words, the request to address this from the prima facie standpoint was to enable the board to dismiss or move on complaints that had or did not have merit. And the determination of prima facie really has to do with whether or not the board has jurisdiction to entertain the complaint at all. So it was an effort to simplify things. The language in the A7 regarding the procedure, one board member is going to look at it, then the second board member, then the full board. That's all the request of the campaign board, and they felt just because of their makeup of the board and the geographics of it, it would be a simpler way to handle it. As to the lawsuit, what the board is, if I understand correctly, deleting a cause of action in district court, and what we are simply proposing is to put in a reference to an existing statute that provides for a cause of action in district court. And so the idea to put in reference to 10A34, I think, was my idea after Mr. Goldsmith had described to us that is the statute that they would proceed under for purposes of the district court action. So I think that there is some misunderstanding there, and maybe Mr. Goldsmith could explain it a little further. But my understanding of what this would do and Representative Lane's understanding is really quite different.
Okay, and that's the same. That's the discussion we need to have around this, the same as we've had it around 1986 and 1961. We need to clarify these issues.
So, Representative Lane, Gary is at the, Mr. Goldsmith is at the front of the table. If you want to give us some information, Mr. Goldsmith.
Certainly. First of all, of course, when you do go over this, the A7 simply makes changes to a lot of amendments to the board's technical bill that were made in the Senate file itself, and so those provisions in the Senate file would need to be looked at as well. But I can look at the A7, and first of all, I do want to clarify that this isn't the board's language. At best, we can say this is the executive director's language with some input from primarily Mr. Sandy, a board member. When we first met as a rules subcommittee at the board with Mr. Sandy and Mr. Beck, a retired administrative law judge, to come up with a recommendation on how the prima facie determination would be made was actually simpler than the language that's included in the A7 amendment. However, it was my understanding that the Senate was going to push to go forward with some version of its language, and so my goal was to get a version that would work for the board and that would be acceptable to the Senate to meet its goals. So to say that this is the board's language or the board's recommendation isn't exactly a fair characterization, but it does result in language that we feel we can administer and we think tends to meet the goal of the Senate. Having said that, I will comment on certain parts of the A7 amendment first, and then further, if you want me to comment on something else, I will. The board's recommendation actually was that the definition of prima facie determination be left for the rulemaking process, and the reason for that, and when I say the board, I mean the executive director and the board members who sit on the rulemaking committee. The reason that we say that is because this definition has had the input of a couple of people, me, Mr. Sandy, a couple of board staff. It hasn't had the benefit of a lot of people looking at it, sifting through it, and figuring out how it might play out in practice. And one of the benefits of rulemaking is that you get a lot of people involved to sift through various scenarios and tell us where something doesn't work. So this definition is one that we think works, but it hasn't been tried and it hasn't been vetted through a whole lot of people who might be affected by it. But if it is to go in statute, this is one that we think we can make work. The next several lines of
Mr. Goldsmith. The first thing I wanted to ask, does that answer the first question that you had regarding some of the confusion of the language?
No, I think he's about ready to go into some
more detail. And then also, the board member Sandy, too, I'd like him to also be part of this conversation as well. So go ahead, Mr. Goldsmith.
Sure.
I didn't mean to.
The next several lines relate to the change from expedited rulemaking to regular rulemaking, and as I mentioned at the previous hearing, it would be at least staff, and I think Mr. Beck made it very clear that it would be his preference to have expedited rulemaking if we have to do a rulemaking. Certainly, we don't have any problem providing whatever notice anybody wants to, whoever wants it. We would do this anyway because we believe that the elections committees in both bodies should be partners with what we do and know what we do at every step. So whatever you want to put in with for notice, we're comfortable with. Otherwise, we would do it anyway. The section that Representative Lane was talking about that I actually wrote to most of you over the weekend about that I thought became problematic, even though it borrows from both language that I originally suggested and the language that I worked with Senator Hoffman on. This is another example of why rulemaking is a good thing, because you get to work through this language over a long period of time. But it has to do with this concept of probable cause. So we're past the prima facie determination to the situation where the board sits down as a whole board, has both parties appear before it if they want to, in writing and in person, and looks at a complaint and is trying to make a decision whether an investigation happens. And Mr. Sandy and I have had discussions with Senator Hoffman and Senator Newman, and in those discussions, Mr. Sandy made it clear that we believed that the discussion or the board's decision would be whether this complaint merits a full formal investigation. And after I talked actually with one of your staffers on Friday explaining the difference between how we do things now and how they would work under the bill, I was thinking about this on my ride home, which turned out to be a very long one because of a signal light that was out. And when I say long, I mean more than 2 hours. It occurred to me that the language that we had used, which says the board must determine whether the complaint sets forth probable cause that a violation has occurred, and if it does, we have to investigate, doesn't actually accomplish what Mr. Sandy and I were telling Senator Hoffman and Senator Newman we thought was going to be accomplished. In other words, not only an analysis of the strength of the complaint, but the seriousness of the violation. And in my email to people, I suggested, we actually had a complaint where the violation was somebody hadn't filed a report. and it still wasn't filed. So it was an ongoing violation. And under a rule that says we don't investigate frivolous complaints, we didn't investigate that because the board knew the report was late. The board had been in communication with the treasurer. The late filing fee was already started and running. So the only thing that the complaint would have done would be elevate the ultimate result from a civil penalty and late filing fee and a filed report to a finding. And the language that we have, and as I say, I have looked at the language quite a bit, even up until Friday, the language that we have doesn't give the board any option to not investigate as long as the complaint states facts that lead to a conclusion that there's probable cause that a violation existed. So my suggestion, I think I gave some language, was a violation sufficient to warrant a full investigation exists. So that was what I think Senator Representative Lane was.
Excuse me, Gary. Can you just repeat where you're talking here so particularly Ms. Stengel understands? Yeah,
I think
that's kind of like almost an amendment is what you're talking about.
I see that.
It would be.
Thank you, Gary. Thanks.
I think it would occur wherever the phrase probable cause to believe a violation has occurred would read probable cause to believe that a violation that warrants a formal investigation has occurred.
Does that, Representative Lane, get to that?
That's the first one I brought up, yes.
Yeah, so.
So it's 2.18, my understanding, and 2.21 and 2.22.
I didn't have time to go through each place where that occurs, and I know it's more than once.
So, Representative Lane, that's something that's you brought up to me was of a concern, and Gary just brought that. Is that something you want to move on that to get that language?
I would rather put these things out and make sure that they're drafted correctly rather than move on them in a hot ad hoc sort of way.
Okay. Gary, you want to keep going?
Sure.
Mr. Goldsmith, sorry.
So that actually, the whole section on page 2 of the A7 is language that, as I say, Mr. Sandy, myself, and the senators worked out as something that we could then administer and we thought would accomplish with this change the purpose of the Senate. Again, this is staff language, not board language, but as the executive director, it's something I feel that we could implement it if it passes. I wanted to go on then to comment on the two other sections of the A7 that give me some concern. Particularly, we're looking at lines 4.14 through 4.16, and this is the addition of the phrase without just cause in three places. This, and I'm going to actually turn to the division. On page 7 of the Senate bill, so this is the new provision that would require people to cooperate when we're trying to reconcile two reports filed with us that report different things, where they should report the same. In other words, the donor says I gave X, the recipient doesn't have the matching receipt coming in. And it happens all the time. It's been a big issue lately, and we have no way to make sure people actually cooperate with us or even respond to us when we ask them to help explain what's going on, because one of them has to be wrong. And so the first part of this provision, Section 10 of the Senate bill, and it's the same in the underlying bill, the same provision as in both bills, it's the board recommendation, it requires cooperation in the reconciliation process. And then, like other things that people have to do under Chapter 10A, if they don't do them, it imposes a late filing fee for not complying. And if they still don't do them, we send a certified letter, and there can be a civil penalty. And if they intentionally or willfully don't do them, there can be an additional civil penalty. Now, keep in mind, the board's job and the board's mission is not to collect money. The board's job is to get accurate and complete reports in as quickly as possible. But it has proven very true that civil penalties and late filing fees are an effective tool, just the fact that they're there, an effective tool to get those things done. And so the way it works is that when the late filing, when the when the late filing fee occurs, and this is in every program, campaign finance reports, economic interest statements, lobbyists and principal reports, they're all the same, and this is modeled after all of them. When the date passes for the compliance, the late filing fee starts. And after a certain period, the board can send a certified letter to start a civil penalty. In all cases, the practice of the board is that when the late filing fee letter or civil penalty letter goes out, the board says you can ask for a waiver of this penalty if you have a reason that you couldn't do this. Now, also keep in mind that in this particular situation, this isn't a report with a fixed due date. This is something where we're working with a committee trying to resolve an issue. So the late filing fee isn't actually even going to start automatically. It won't start until they stop cooperating or ignore us. The problem with adding the words without just cause, so on page 7, line 33, if the association without just cause fails to provide the required information, we can impose a late filing fee. The problem is, in some cases, they simply won't have communicated with us. And so we don't know whether they had just cause or they're ignoring us or they put the letter in a stack of letters and left it. And that's the case with all of our programs. That's the reason why late filing fees, like traffic speeding tickets, happen once the event occurs. And unlike a speeding ticket, you can go and explain why you didn't get the thing done on time. And if it's a health reason or a family emergency or things like that, the board then will take that into consideration and typically waives the late filing fee or the civil penalty. So my concerns are two. One is that you can't impose a late filing fee under this proposed language probably almost ever because you'd never know that it was without just cause. And secondly, it would carve out a small exception in this statute regarding reconciliation that would make the process different than for every other late filing fee or civil penalty process the board administers. At some future time, if you want to, I would suggest that it might be more appropriate that a language be added somewhere else in 10A02 that says that the board must waive late filing fees or civil penalties for just cause. But to require us to determine that there was no just cause before we impose them is really impossible. And then finally, on page 12, line 11, this is the other section that Representative Lane talked about. I'm going to turn to that as well and remind members, I think I mentioned this at the last committee meeting, that this particular subdivision takes place only after a conciliation process has occurred. And conciliation has to occur, it's required by statute, if there's a spending limits violation or a contribution limits violation. So there are never investigations for those types of violations. It's conciliation. We ask them about it, they explain it. If it happened, it happened. If it didn't, they amend their report and fix it. So that's the subdivision that comes before the one that's in the board bill. So now we get to subdivision 4, which is on line 12.10. So this says if we can't conciliate because they won't agree or they don't respond or something, if we can't conciliate within a reasonable time and correct it by informal methods, and the board was proposing to strike a matter that constitutes probable cause because in conciliation you don't have a finding of probable cause. It's reported on the report. They've reported I took too much money or I spent too much money. So, and because it's an informal process, you don't have that standard. It's because there's reason to believe that this violation occurs. And it is not going to result in findings or an order at this point. But so those were the board's recommendations. And if that fails, then the board must make a public finding. So at that point, it would be elevated to an investigative type process. These are actually cleanup bits from the language that you passed last year, changing what the board does from making findings of probable cause to simply making findings. Now, the last part is a lot of language that's stricken. And first of all, this requirement, if you read it carefully, says after we make that finding, we have to, the board must bring an action in district court to collect the civil penalty. Well, I don't know if any of you have ever had civil penalties, but almost everybody just pays them or asks the board to reduce them, but ultimately they get paid. We almost never sue to collect the civil penalty, and yet this language actually said we had to sue to collect. As a matter of fact, there's an administrative rule that contradicts this because the board long ago recognized that it made no sense to require litigation when somebody's going to pay something voluntarily. So there's a rule that actually contradicts this, but we felt it was time to remove the language that mandates a lawsuit.
And we still can't sue if someone doesn't pay right under the
right
rule.
And so the in the A7, the Senate suggests that we add that the board may use Section 10A.34 to recover fees and penalties to, or seek an injunction. And that's what 10A.34 says. In any action, you can sue or seek an injunction. So to add that, again, in this section is really completely redundant. And finally, the last part that we strike is about money going into the general fund. That's already encoded in a different statute. So, again, on this one, the board would recommend that its original language be adopted. We think it does what needs to be done in this particular regard.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. Mr. Sandy, did you want to add anything to that? And then Senator Newman, I know, wants to say some things, and then I guess.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't really have anything to add other than to point out I don't think you find anyone in Minnesota who knows more about campaign finance law than our executive director. And I think that he's hit upon some clarification issues that I hope the conference committee is able to put into this legislation without much difficulty. He did, as he indicated, send around an email to certain members, and if that hasn't reached Ms. Stengel and Mr. Guerin, we can certainly forward that to them with these proposals. I only have really three comments. I'll start with working backwards through Mr. Goldsmith. Regarding the removal of the district court action, that just seems to me to get rid of an unnecessary and a redundant provision that should not be that difficult to do. With respect to the issue of just cause, in the language, I believe this is an issue for Senator Newman, and so I'm curious to hear what his thoughts are. Just I'll explain the way I see it as a board member myself. When we get issues that come in front of us as civil penalties, staff sets it out very easily in a memo that is in the regular session, isn't it, Gary? So I can speak about it publicly. It's on the agenda. Anyone sees it, and I believe it comes through, if it works right, in color-coded fashion with recommendations from staff as to whether they believe a waiver should be granted based on the facts of the situation, what someone has said, and also what we've done in the past. And when it's a judgment call and when staff doesn't believe that a waiver should be granted, and, you know, the board doesn't always agree with them. But I think that system works well right now. We have granted waivers. We've talked about when we should reduce it. And so I guess it's up to the committee if you want to include the language, but I sort of feel like right now, if it's not broken, we don't really need to fix it. And at least in my short term on the board, I haven't heard people complaining about that process. Prior to my joining the board, I did represent parties and followed what was going on in the board, and even then I didn't hear people complaining about it. But I do point, those are my observations with all due respect to Senator Newman, and so I'm curious about what his thoughts are. Finally, with respect to the issue of the clarification of language of probable cause, I think Mr. Goldsmith has hit upon an area that is a pretty easy clarification that will get rid of some gray area. We chatted about this morning, and my view is that if we can't effectuate that minor change, the board could still operate within the legislative intent. But I think that clarifies the intent.
And then my final observation overall is, and this is me as an individual board member and also as a campaign finance lawyer who has worked with the board quite extensively, that even predates my admission to the bar when I was a law clerk. I think that this proposal in Senate File 2402 regarding board procedures, while it may not have come about in a real pretty way and without, admittedly, Representative Lane, much input, if any, from the House, it is a good improvement for how this process works. And the challenge that I have noticed in my short time on the board is that when I hear grousing in the community about the way board investigations go, if there's a pending investigation, I can't even acknowledge that the investigation exists. And so it's difficult for me to be responsive to people when they have complaint over a current investigation. So what I would, my observation to the committee members is the best way for us to deal with complaints over investigations is the way that we're talking about it right now, which is to deal with the process. The easiest response to me, I couldn't even after this has passed, I still wouldn't be able to acknowledge that an investigation exists. But what I might point out in the abstract to someone who is unhappy with an investigation is look at the rules, look at the law, and see where there is a process that exists for you to air your the way you might approach this investigation. That doesn't exist right now. And it's something that's bothered me for a very long time, going back, you know, to 1992, when I was involved in the Senator Novak versus Ethical Practices Board litigation. And I do think that we have an opportunity to fix that now, as this has come about. I would hate to miss this opportunity, but I've listened to the House members in particular, and I do understand why you feel that way.
Thank you, Mr. Sandy. Any questions for Mr. Goldsmith or Mr. Sandy before I know Senator Newman has some comments? Senator Newman?
Just the two of the issues, the insertion of the without just cause phrase, that is something that I would like to have in there. It is a phrase that I think lawyers in particular are familiar with, and it does nothing more than give an individual an opportunity to provide a reason to the board as to why they have not complained. And I can think of any number of circumstances under which someone may be receiving mail and being requested to provide information and they, in fact, do not receive it. I agree with the board that they want to have the ability to make this requirement. I don't have any disagreement with that. And I'm candidly very surprised at the pushback by the board to refuse to put in there a phrase of without just cause. And it that alone makes me a little bit concerned that if you say you have the authority to grant a waiver, fine, but give the individual an opportunity to present a reason why that waiver should be granted. And that's all that phrase means, without just cause. Insofar as the civil action is concerned, I respectfully disagree with Mr. Goldsmith. In the existing language, it says the board must bring a civil action, but the board does not have to bring that action if, in fact, the individual voluntarily pays the fine. And so I'm a little surprised at the pushback there. Having said that, I do not disagree with the board in striking the language at section 18 beginning on line 12.9. I don't disagree with that. I don't feel comfortable with the phrase where the board is going to make a public finding in the matter and then just leave it hanging. Where are people supposed to go with that after you have made that statement in the statute? I'm simply suggesting you make a reference to 10A34 if that is in fact the remedy that the board will avail themselves of. It is not a significant change. It is simply a statutory reference.
Thank you, Senator Newman.
So
I would
would like to make one comment.
Sure.
To the first part of what he said, I can't address the second part. That would be up to Mr. Goldsmith. But the first part, where without just cause, my understanding is that what you're really looking for is the opportunity for somebody to have a waiver on the basis of just cause. And that the suggestion was that in another place in statute, it would very well fit to say things would be waived for just cause, and that would cover more than this particular area, but all areas. But this would just be one unique area, and that where it's being stuck in there. But in fact, your intent is to have it cover a larger area, and that belongs in another place in statute, which would maybe be something that we'd have to find that spot. And then what your intent would be satisfied. This would be kind of a ad hoc, one little area rather than covering the whole area. Is that correct, Mr. Goldsmith?
Senator Moon, Mr. Goldsmith?
I think so, and I apologize if it sounded like I was pushing back. I didn't really intend to. What I was trying to clarify was that the way I would read the language as proposed would be that we would not be able to impose a late filing fee unless we determined that the person didn't have just cause for not filing. And if the person is simply not communicating, there's no way to make that determination, so there would be no way to impose a late filing fee. The practice of the board is to impose the late filing fee, and then when somebody says, I don't want to pay it, we ask them why, and if they have a good reason, then we waive it. And so, yes, to Representative Lane's question, somewhere in 10A02, which governs general board operations, could be a provision that would say that in all cases the board may or must waive, probably must waive, a late filing fee or civil penalty for good cause shown.
And Representative Lane, and that's my understanding of where Senator Newman is going with it. It's just like when you send somebody a notice to appear, or a notice to, you know, a question, you have 10 days to respond and you're out of the country, but they say, look, I hand-delivered this to your P.O. box or your mailbox. You know, my just cause why I didn't respond to your inquiry was because I was out of the country or whatever. I mean, there's probably few and far between that you're going to have, but nonetheless, we wanted to make sure that that was covered. Isn't that – I mean, that's exactly where Senator Newman was going with that. So if that covers – if what Gary is saying would cover that piece of it, then I think we would be okay having that language inserted in that other section and having this not reflected. Is that – do you have the same understanding?
Yes. I saw this one section of statute, Mr. Goldsmith is without question more knowledgeable about the statutes than I am. And if he says that there – that this same phrase is in other areas of our statute, Representative Lane, you are correct. It would be my intent to put them in the other places.
So, if Mr. Chair, if we could have staff find that appropriate place where it could be all cases, in all cases, it would be for just cause, that would satisfy it overall through the whole section.
That's what I'm hearing. Is that, Representative Lane, if I could just, the Muskie bill passed, by the way. They didn't need my vote on that. So anyway, go ahead.
What length?
Okay. 60 inches. Go ahead.
Another piece, but I don't know if
is there another piece, Senator Newman, that you wanted to?
No,
So here we are.
This one to death.
We have. What is the? Go ahead.
One more section for the not the A7, but the Senate bill that I would like a response from Mr. Goldsmith to see how that fits in. It has to do with the Section 7. Of the Senate bill. It would be on our Senate, I think. And there was some understanding that it is misplaced in, again, another place where the intent isn't what is satisfied in this use, is my understanding that the it does something than the other than the actual Senate intent. Am I right, Mr. Goldsmith?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lane, I think so. This is a sort of a little used part of the statute, but it sets the time at which the board would make a decision about whether some particular piece of information that might harm an innocent person would either be returned to that person or kept private and then disposed of after a year. And so the typical time for doing that would be at the conclusion when other materials would become public, and that typically is at the time that the board makes a finding, and it wouldn't be concerning probable cause. It would be, and I have to see what, I think there was nothing in the board. Let me check what the... we know what the original language was?
The Senate side?
We look at the House side, right. Right. Since we don't make findings concerning probable cause at the end of the investigation, we make findings. So the typical time when you'd make a decision about whether data is going to be maintained as private data or given back to an innocent person would be at the time we made the public finding, which is how we conclude an investigation, or at the time we enter into a conciliation agreement, which is at the time that we conclude a matter that's handled by conciliation agreement. And so those would be the times. Since it says after determining whether there's a prima facie violation, theoretically you could make that determination any time after, but as a practical matter, at that point, once you make the prima facie determination, you haven't started an investigation, you have no evidence, and you would have no idea what might need to be maintained as private later on. So the original language that the board had, I think, accomplishes what needs to be accomplished, and I'm not really sure what the purpose or intent of this language was.
Thank you.
Yeah. I couldn't say my words.
Representative Lyon.
Works for me. The host side, as the board had presented it, if after making a public finding or entering a conciliation agreement, then the record of that investigation now is returned to a person or kept private or whatever. That's what we're talking about. The data after that point, after a public finding or entering a conciliation agreement, then the record of that investigation is what's being talked about. Whereas when the Senate changes it, they change it from a public determination as to whether a complaint alleges a prima facie violation. Now, that... all the record of that is the subject that is being talked about in this paragraph now. And no longer are you talking about the public finding or the entering into a conciliation agreement, and the record of that investigation now has disappeared off the page. But instead, you're just talking about the public determination as to whether a complaint alleges a prima facie violation. That record, which would be very small, is now given back or whatever. So you've changed the whole intent. By trying to do something around the prima facie, you've changed the intent of how things are handled later on in a bigger investigation.
And Representative Lyon, you know, the intent of the prima facie was specifically was to allow when somebody is given notice, if somebody knows something's happening, I want to know that you've now filed something against me. I want to know. I want to have the ability to respond. Writing, the ability to respond, and if it sounds to me like the concern is, what if it goes to the next level? If you're thinking that this first prima facie has more teeth to it than later on, I guess I would be interested in finding out what you would have as an alternative or a solution to that, because you know I think we're at a point where we can spend the next 3 days. Wordsmith in this. And
actually, I think this is the end of
you think it's the end of your...
Of the things that were difficult in the way they were written.
You know, and I know... So, I guess, what do you...
I think that your concerns about prima facie actually fall somewhere else in the A7. This one was like one more attempt to throw something in there around it, and I think it was putting it in the wrong place and changing something that is important and that you would not want to lose. But you lose it by changing it just to the prima facie violation. Now that record is handled right. But what happens after a public finding or a major public finding after an investigation or a conciliation agreement, that major investigation piece now is not being talked about here as to what you would do with that information. So you lost a piece rather than gained a piece, in my opinion.
Okay. Gary.
Mr. Chair, keep in mind and read line 6.27 through 30. This particular provision has nothing to do with the record of the investigation. It has nothing to do with whether the board can talk about whether probable cause was found or the prima facie finding, and it has nothing to do with what gets disclosed to the other party. This says that at a certain point in time, which we're talking about what is that point in time, but at a certain point in time, if the board finds that it has something in the file that would unfairly damage an innocent person, the board can do one of two things: keep it for a year and then destroy it, or give it back to the person. So this really has nothing to do with most of the investigation, and this has only been used once that I know of in my 17 years with the board, and it resulted in striking a few lines in a deposition about somebody who had been fired, and that person was an innocent person. So this doesn't have anything to do with the things you're talking about, and that's why it seems to me that the time that you decide whether to protect this innocent person is when things would otherwise become public, which is when we make a finding or enter into a conciliation agreement.
Is that
right? So it seems like the original language would be the better language.
I'm fine. I mean, if we want to do the original language, is that better language, then, you know, I'm okay with that. Senator Newman, you okay with that? Does anybody want to?
My suggestion, Mr. Chair,
at this Representative
point is draft up, because it's kind of hanging out here right now, but draft up some of these things clearly so everybody can see them in actual form. What I would call corrections that we talked about, and also the expedited rulemaking. Draft that up, and then we come back with whatever else is left on the list, and then what we want to do at that point.
So we're running out of time, and it seems like there's lots of these conferencing committees going on. So any suggestions as to how much time we're going to need? Because I think we're still, you know, here's still the elephant in the room that Senator Newman.
If we have something drafted up and come back and talking about it again, I'm not at all sure what we're going to have drafted up, because I don't know if there's any consensus here.
I hear you, Senator. No, I agree. Which is unfortunate.
I don't know where to go with this, because I don't know that there's a consensus for some kind of new amendment.
Representative Lane, having that bit of information, you know, how willing are you to negotiate 1986 and 1961?
I heard Ms. Chair's strong comments about 1986, the gift ban, bringing that back. Surprises me, but that's a side point. 1961, it had the permission it must do audits as per resources, and then the underlying data would be kept confidential. It had the if your spouse has a – if you're going to vote on something that will be a conflict of interest, a gain to your spouse, you would recuse yourself from that vote. And it had a listing on an economic interest statement, if you were an independent contractor, what that category would be in the IRS list, just what the category would be. I didn't hear anything about that last one. I heard some comments about the conflict of interest, although I thought it was mostly a misunderstanding, but it's just recusing yourself. However, is there something about number three, the independent contractors, and just having that part in the economic interest statement where that category would be listed? It doesn't get down to very deep. It doesn't say very much. It's just the general category of your work.
So if I understand you, you'd be willing to just have that and... Because I think the piece here that is worrisome to a lot of senators is just the piece about the official, you know, the official or the official spouse. And if you're not willing to move on that, then you know, why even have this conversation anymore? And that's just, but if you're willing to move on that and just go with, you know, what I hear, statements of economic interest that are related to 10A.09,
I'm suggesting that the supposed conflict of interest, what the discussion we heard here, I thought was a misunderstanding of what it was, that it was a financial, that they adjust their finances. And it's not. It's much looser than that. It's just simply if they're going to make a major gain on something, you're a unique and significant interest in something you're voting on, you would recuse yourself. And nobody would know why, except that you'd write out something, I guess, to your leadership, but nobody would know why. So it's very private. So I'm looking for a couple of things out of this.
Okay. Senator Newman, do you understand that side of it?
Well, you know, I do, and I appreciate it, and how many more conference committees we can come back and bang around on this, because we're frankly we're beginning to run out of time. I am beginning to reach the point where I would just say let's go up and down vote on these various amendments and see how things come out.
So are you making a motion that we do that now
I don't know. I personally am not comfortable making motions on various things because it's too airy-fairy right now. There's too many unfinished pieces. They need to be brought together and gelled, and then we would know what we're voting on. But if you're not comfortable in even considering the possibility of coming back and considering any part of this 1961, then maybe we can call it quits. Or we could recess and think about it.
Recess for 5 minutes and think about it?
No, I'm thinking about a day.
Tomorrow's going to be a busy day, Representative Lane, and everybody's serious about getting out of here. I don't like to draw lines in sand. I mean, I thought we really had something good, but I just, you know, when you start bringing that stuff back, there's some, I have a hard, not only just me, there are people that we're accountable to, that our colleagues on the Senate side that have a hard time with both these provisions. So,
and we broke down one of them into half of it.
So yes, so we're making progress. I would be okay to that. Take a recess and give a day to think. And otherwise, I mean, if we're not willing, I mean, if I can't get support on the House side, then I agree with
support
you.
Support on the House side.
On our A7 amendment and looking at, you know, I've heard both Mr. Sandy say that, you know, the Senate language is good. Gary, Mr. Goldsmith brought up some things or that, you know, we could make some tweaks to, which I think we've agreed to some of those as well. So
as I said, those were my concerns about the A7. We've discussed them all, and there seems to be an agreement to put them together in that clarification form. Then the A7 at least isn't a point that we can then actually look at and compare them to some part of 1961. There's where we stand as far as I see it, and either we can adjourn or we can recess.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
It's 287. Tell me if I'm hearing this correctly, that the A7 would be acceptable to the House with the exception of inserting in the various chapters that Mr. Goldsmith was talking about, so that we have consistency throughout our statutes, the without just cause phrase.
Okay.
Is that what I am?
There's several pieces. That's one of them.
And so what I think we need to do, and you're kicking me. I didn't mean to cut you off, Representative Lane, but sounds like Mr. Goldsmith and Mr. Sandy could work with staff on those changes to make sure that we're all on the set. Is that an agreement we can do on? I'm willing to come back one more time.
And if that's what we're talking about,
yep.
And other than, you know, inserting the without just cause phrase into the appropriate places of the statute so that we have consistency that Representative Lane is talking about, if once we get that done, the House will take language, then we talk about some modifications. I think it's on 1961, then I think it would be worthwhile coming back.
Well, I would just say that we went through four different things. One of them is that, and two more off the A7, and one off the Senate file about the misunderstanding of after an investigation. So there's those four items plus the expedited rulemaking would address our concerns about the things that the Senate has that the House does not.
Okay.
Will staff work with?
Okay. So with that, let's
recess.
and get the call of the chair, which will be back to you.
Thank you.